Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to Sentimental Garbage, the podcast where all unsaved changes will unfortunately be lost. My name is Caroline and I put my swims in a swimming pool, then took the ladder away. Joining me is the woman who has married every single person in Stardew Valley, Sarah Maria Griffin. I married Shane in Stardew Valley because I'm basic.
Oh, Shane is emotional hard road, but you do get the blue chickens, so, you know. My personal favourite is Elliot because I like to mirror my own lived experience of living in total isolation and writing books.
Oh, yes.
Long, fabulous hair by the ocean. What a man.
What a man. So today we're talking about girl games, which is a difficult thing to quantify because obviously, you know, you want to start with the thing that video games are for everyone. Mm. And that is definitely how they started. Video games were for everyone. And then a diversion happened, which I'm interested in getting into, where they became a very hyper-masculinized space, and then women were sort of siloed into girl games. And I'm talking The Sims, Neopets, Nintendogs, Harvest Moon, Stardew Valley, all this stuff that like was highly feminine in its sort of design and also tended to be less about motor skills and reactions and more about decision and turn-based things and resource management. Mm. Do you think that's accurate?
I think it is. I think The Sims especially is something that was probably designed for everyone.
Yes.
But it found its nesting place and its growing place in the lives of untold quantities of women. Every so often I meet somebody and I start talking about video games and they reach across and they say, "Did you ever play The Sims?" As though, did you belong to this dark secret club
of
women who ached away hours building and constructing these detailed, fictional, perfect sandbox lives or totally off the walls crackers, murder factories where untold horrors to these digital people. But everybody's experience with The Sims is different, but it's something that seems to matter a huge deal to people, but also feels sort of private in that almost every conversation I've had with a girl who plays The Sims is, it feels like it just belonged to them.
Yeah.
And I think that's really, really special. You know?
And it's interesting because Sims feels like something that would be natural for like an open world online game.
Yeah.
And yet hasn't happened because I think we know it's a private world you create just for yourself. Mm,
and that's the real magic with video games, I think, and why I go to them and why I know a lot of people go to them, which is this sort of sense of transport or this sort of like passageway into a different place, a calmer or wilder or better place. You know, it's another world. And that sounds very silly and very childish, but it's not childish because play simply cannot just be for children. Play is so holistic and it's I don't know. I think it's more important than work.
Yeah.
And I will put a video game down if it feels like work. I'll tell you. I really, really will. The second it starts to feel like labor, I'm like... And I don't know what that magical quantity is. Where the point at which, you know, growing fairy roses to get a very specific kind of expensive honey in Stardew Valley doesn't feel like labor to me. It feels like joy.
It is just tasks and arduous things.
But there's something else.
There's an ineffable thing that makes the arduous tasks and the waiting for spring to come so you can grow the certain thing pleasurable.
The resource management, right? Which again, as a phrase, sounds like hell on earth.
Yeah.
You know, if I was presented with a job opportunity that says the primary feature of this job is resource management, I would be like, oh, that simply is not for me.
Yeah.
A video game, however, resource management can mean anything from running your farm to collecting pieces of flowers and teeth from animals to build tiny effigies, you know, or it can be running a bed and breakfast on a boat that leads people across the river to the underworld as it is in Spiritfarer. There are so many different ways to manage your little bits and pieces. Animal Crossing is a resource management game. I don't know what it is about keeping these things in order that feels good. And I think it is something to do with power fantasy and control fantasy, but that's a whole... Oh, that's a whole other thing. So.
It's a whole thing that I do want to get into in a big way.
Yeah, yeah, for
but
sure.
But before we do, let me just like tell everyone your creds, I guess. So you're a novelist like me, but you also do a strong line in video games journalism. And I think the way you write and talk about video games in both journalism like The Guardian and I think Kotaku as well.
Yeah, I had my first one. That was a real like...
Very cool! Ooh,
my first one. It was very exciting to finally get to write for Kotaku. I've been reading them for more years than I can count, and to finally cross that bridge was really
special.
I mean,
it's
really
the big special. American cool one.
Oh my God, it was so... I'm just delighted by it, you know.
But
thrilling.
Even before that, on your social media, you were always this person... I mean, you're close friend. But yes. You are the reason that I got into games again as an adult, really, because I started playing games, you know, with my brothers when I was 6 or 7, you know. We had a Sega, and then we had a PlayStation, but then we had a Game Boy, and for me, I fell in love with games with the Pokemon games, and I'll still buy every single one of those games when they come out, even though it is throwing money into a hole.
I gotta respect your commitment to the bit. Every so often when a new Pokemon game comes out, I get a text from you that's just enraged by it, rightly so. And I do remember the first...
I'm just throwing good money after bad. You know?
Gotta catch them all, buddy, you know? And we're chasing that feeling, right?
Yeah.
We're chasing that feeling of being a child that is touching the surface of another world. Like my first experience with Pokemon was that my dad had downloaded a set of emulators onto our household PC, and I played Pokemon Blue on the PC with my two hands crossed over each other because I'm left-handed and I don't always... computer keyboard play is very difficult for me. So with one hand over the other until my wrist went dead, I would use the tiny 4 arrow buttons on the side of the keyboard with the numbers and then the space bar as enter. And I navigated Pokemon like with my arms across each other like this.
Aww.
The whole way to the Elite Four alone without anybody to talk to about it because it felt... strange, and it wasn't a game that anybody... It was before it was out. It was a hack. It was a translation made by like fans. And then when it hit our televisions, my whole world was completely rocked. Like I suddenly had this deep secret. But unfortunately, it was not a secret shared by any of the girls I knew.
Oh, lonely.
I was maybe 11, maybe less, maybe 10. Very, very young. And that is not a juncture at which in the 90s, to that sort of 90s to noughties juncture that you want to be... suddenly not like other girls, which is a really important part of talking about being a teenage girl who plays video games. But with your writing about Pokemon, you wrote a really brilliant essay for The Guardian, and that was when our conversation really started about video games, where I realized that you were as into it as in terms of your inner life as a hobby. It was something that meant something to you. That landscape from Pallet Town all the way across had lodged in you, and that was when I was like, oh, wait, hold on. We've been to the same place. We visited the same country.
Yeah.
What did you find there?
Yeah.
You know?
And it's but then, you know, talking about video games, and then you started sort of chucking me recommendations, and this is going to make people furious, this next bit of the conversation, because it would make me furious. But I wrote this essay, it's like 2,000 words. Long essay for The Guardian about my love of Pokemon and how it sort of taught me how to build stories. And then Nintendo sent me a Switch.
Is that what happened? Oh, Caroline, I'm on the floor.
Going, no, fuck me. Fuck my drag.
Floor. Fuck my drag, Caroline. That's amazing.
But then that with that came this, the first real adult portal into gaming, and also COVID hit.
Yeah.
So I was getting into indie games for the first time. This place where, and I do think that, like, to diverge, you know, the 90s, our generation, millennials, the first sort of generation of people who, like, grew up with games as the norm, and most people, like, most people of most economic backgrounds that I knew had some kind of thing you could play games on in your house.
Yeah, something. I mean? Yeah,
they
yeah.
had something. If it was Game Boy, whatever. And so everyone just had some experience of games in their life. And they were for everybody. Like, Mario was for everyone. Donkey yeah. Kong was for everyone. I played all these games with my brothers and there was no, like, differentiation of how much we were enjoying
them. They were like
them.
Lego.
Like right? Lego. Like, yeah. precisely, like Lego. And then, I think in the noughties, a sort of a confluence of things happened, both in the culture and in games, which is that, I mean, ding, 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 we're talking about millennials in the noughties and I'm about to bring up 9/11. Take a shot.
Yeah.
I think actually this entire podcast might just be an investigation of how 9/11 changed our cultural lives. But so the culture, 9/11 happens, the internet happens, and also games, graphic cards just get better and better. And the every year the industry is learning more about itself and improving itself. And it's like an exponential growth moment. So games are looking more realistic than ever. Everyone has the internet, so everyone becomes obsessed with sort of shocking themselves.
Mm.
Looking on Rotten.com.
I was about to say, Hail Mary, Mother of God, Rotten.com.
Rotten.com. Yeah, yeah. And like finding the goriest, worst sort of blue waffle lemon party.
Waiting
like,
for them to load on the screen, gathered around.
Line
with
by
people,
line.
And just
car
holding the chair
victims.
And waiting to see something that would make you feel anything. Like,
and you're 12. Man. And then also 9/11 happens, and then what the knock-on effect of that is the sort of hyper-militarization of the culture, right?
Yeah.
This thing of like boys who are not much older than the boys playing consoles in their bedrooms are going off to war and they're dying. And I also credit this with the naughty sort of obsession with gore horror, like Saw, like Hostel, young people being tortured. It's like everyone needed to confront what that might be like, because everyone was like, oh yeah, my brother or me could happen.
Thrumming away in the background.
It's thrumming away. It's a little heartbeat yeah. under the floorboard. And so then we get in 2003, like we get Call of Duty.
And then nothing is ever the same again.
And nothing is ever the same again. And what happens is every video game shop you go into, it's a wall of Call of Duty and the games that come after Call of Duty.
Yeah, I know.
Halo, all this stuff. It's not only is it like not for a female sensibility, it is actively invested in keeping women out, so it itself feels more masculine because of their exclusion.
To this day, every so often on TikTok, a esports professional who happens to be a woman will pop up on my timeline and will play the audio of things that men, grown men, will say to her on pure recognition of her being a woman online. Still. And it's those first-person shooter games.
Mm-hmm.
I can't play first-person shooters because I get terrible car sickness, which is a lovely excuse. But also, I don't. The aesthetic feel of them makes me unsettle. The sound of gunfire, the sound of rustling body movement through these locations. Mm. There's something about it that it makes me maybe. I just don't think playing war is for me. And I think that there's a lot of people who are driven from video games as a medium because their immediate association with the video game is gun. And I think that when I think about games and guns, I think about, funnily enough, Space Invaders. So the easiest thing when you're building an early object like a video game, right? If you want to see a reaction on screen by pressing a button, if you want to say input, output.
Mm.
Input is the button press, output is the action on screen, right? What is a more simple, straightforward example of that than a bullet from a gun?
Mm.
The medium is intrinsically tied to that bullet.
Button reaction.
You know, for so many games, and Nintendo are really good for this, it's the design of the game comes long before the story. The story starts hanging around the mechanic. You know, Mario's name before his name was Mario was Jumpman, because what does he do?
He jumps.
And that is a great feeling. That's my favorite feeling in video games, is the feeling of the jump. What is it that we simply cannot do out here? Lift into the air and land safely. What a feeling, right? What a feeling. You know? But also, I would imagine for a lot of people, that feeling is also gone, right?
But like, something you said to me, and sorry to crib you from you, but to you, is this thing of like, the first thing we do when a game loads is press X to jump. You're testing out the controller. Beep, beep, beep. Jump, jump, jump.
How does the jump feel?
How does the jump feel?
And the jump feels different across the games, man. Rayman has a different jump to Mario, has a jump to different jump to Donkey Kong, has a different jump to May from Night in the Woods. There's a different jump for everybody.
Yeah,
and
Princess Peach's floating jump.
Oh, and her little brolly that carries her longer and that lovely Game Boy game about her feelings. Like, there's so many different ways to experience that freedom. But Gun is another feeling, and it's a... I don't know what the good part of that feeling is, but I understand it and I recognize that it's a power fantasy.
Yes.
Right? I know why people are drawn to it. It's a cultural drawing, it's a sensation drawing. Also, these games are multiplayer and very early on would have had headsets and microphones and ways to talk to each other and ways to play together. But I don't think that the playing together is kind or warm. I think it's still pretty cruel and pretty dark and I don't know. I can see why it doesn't make gaming feel like a welcoming space to people who might not be interested in that.
Yeah. And I think that's what happened to a lot of girls and women, right? It's like let's say you're 15 in 2003, right? When Call of Duty comes out. I think the options are either get with the program, start moving towards other games that are made for you that you may find either, you know, interesting, like Harvest Moon or Animal Crossing or any of the Nintendogs thing or whatever, or you'll feel patronized by that and you simply age out and never go back to games again. And then games become a thing that men get to keep with them their whole life. Men in general get to keep play their whole life. And that's upsetting to me.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I know lots of men in their 30s who have a weekly football game.
Yeah, five-a-side.
How Gavin kept up with his friends during COVID was, and he doesn't even like games that much, is he played Call of Duty with his friends online, you know? And like, they're just encouraged to play their whole lives in a way that we're encouraged to nurture our whole lives, you know?
Or consume. And to crib you back to a conversation that we had early, God, it must be a couple of weeks ago now, was that the place where women are sent to spend their recreational time always leads back to commerce.
Yeah.
Our self-care ties back to commerce. Buying things to put on our face, buying things to put in our hair, buying things to put on our body. That is our relaxation and our rest. Play is shopping. And I know that that's kind of reductionist. I'm aware that I'm operating at a really simple binary here and things are never as simple as just that.
Yeah.
But I do think that is the world is set up to take women's spare time and funnel it.
Turn it into money.
Into money. Yeah. As opposed to play, which ultimately, I mean, video games aren't free, but play is free.
You spend £60 on the new Zelda game.
And you play it for 5 years.
That's actually a very little return on investment considering how much time you're consuming it.
Breath of the Wild came out in 2017. And twice a year, I get a kind of a little crack in my back and I go, Oh, it's time.
I'm being called back to Hyrule.
To crawl up out of the tomb and go do some stuff with my sailcloth, you know?
When did Skyrim come out? Like 12 years ago?
And it's still moving, it's still growing, people are still going in for the first time. I would imagine Elden Ring will have people returning to it for many, many years to come. There are games that you sit down and you whip through in an afternoon. I'm a big proponent of the short game, as you know. I love a 6-hour jaunt, you know. I love something I can hit in an evening top to bottom.
Something that you can just consume over one weekend and be moved by.
Yes.
And then just kind of move on from, but it's still there in your locker.
Exactly.
You know?
But then there's other games, arguably like Pokemon, like Zelda, big and like Animal Crossing. Crossing, which was a life raft for so many people during that first year, during 2020, that you just get to live in. You just go back there. They're a third or fourth or fifth place where you go to just be somebody else.
A
home inside your home. And The Sims is the very same thing.
It's a home inside your home.
People play for years and years that one object because the active play
sometimes
is free.
One character. You know?
One family, one swimming pool with no one swimming pool. No ladder. But like that's a like I still will open games that I've like there, we still have all of our old consoles and we collect consoles in our house, myself and my husband, and we'll open my old N64, dust it off, blow into a cartridge, and just for the look of, on the screen. And I know that you can play all the old N64 games on the Switch, which is a gift, frankly. But there is something about that feeling and that crunch of something that you played as a child, but still has the depth and worth that it always had, you know? And I don't know, that there is a feeling of, like I keep saying, of leaving the world, as opposed to being constantly reminded that you're in the world, in a body, in a set of responsibilities, which I think, I don't know, I think people who aren't men could probably do with a bit more of.
Yeah.
Bit of freedom.
And that's it. It's like, it's interesting that when we talk about girl games, so much of, resource management and nurturing of things. And it sort of, it makes me a little uncomfortable because, you know, it's that two things can be true at once, which is that, you know, women can feel great joy within these games, but that also that these games compound every negative stereotype about women, is that we enjoy nurturing, we enjoy collecting, all this kind of stuff. And then it's sort of like wrestling with that a little bit. It's like, do we enjoy the game because it's what we've been given and what we've been told is for us? Or is the game responding to something in us that wants to do these things?
I will counter that with, do we enjoy putting on makeup because it makes us feel good and alive? Or do we enjoy makeup because it feels good and alive because we get told we look beautiful in a very particular set of standards? It's that Atwood male fantasies thing, right? That you are looking at yourself through the eyes of a man. Everything that we do is cornered in by the patriarchy, including play, including games. There are plenty of men who love Stardew Valley, plenty of them, you know.
These games, men love Animal Crossing.
Oh my goodness, plenty. But I also would argue, and it is something that I know, again, we're dealing in very hard binaries here, but like, lots of women play Call of Duty, loads of women play Fortnite, you know, like this is a non-exclusive conversation. Absolutely, that there is always going to be more to it than we're discussing.
Yes,
but there is a lineage of games in the medium that are, have drawn historically more women players than anything else. And certainly they do have elements of like moving around the furniture, going to the shop,
but
you know.
Almost, yeah, Sims is almost a brilliant litmus test of that, because it was a game that was built by a man who had a very male game with SimCity, right? That like,
I loved SimCity.
I
love
SimCity.
Oh
as well.
Man, I can see those little pixelated explosions and when things will go wrong.
Oh,
like,
so
it's such
good.
A just crunchy game,
putting down plazas and gardens every which way. But you know, that was a game for everybody. I don't think it really had a gendered thing in mind. But then and I think everybody played it. Certainly, me and my brother played it together, sort of taking turns at the big old PC or whatever. But at a certain point, he left and I stayed, you know, and then me and my friends would sort of like hoard our pocket money or confirmation money or whatever for the expansion
pack. Yeah.
You know, one friend had the first dates, one friend had the animals or whatever. And we would like go around on a Sunday afternoon and just fucking sit there on like a hard dining chair
on the family PC.
And one of you is kind of sitting on a radiator and burning your arse a bit.
It's so funny with the people who come and who don't stay.
Yeah.
My first experience with video games console was my childhood best friend, Steph, who got a Super Nintendo for her Holy Communion. I remember going to game with her and her mum to get this.
I just zoomed out. I was like, this is such two Irish people on a podcast.
I know. On Grafton Street, folks.
Communion money and confirmation money.
I know. And she got a Super Nintendo in a box with a game called Yoshi's Island, which is about Mario's horse, Yoshi.
He is Mario's horse.
And baby Mario, who rides around on pastel Yoshi's back through this beautiful bucolic pastel island to be reunited with his twin brother, baby Luigi. And it came in this gorgeous pastel box and it looked like a toy and it was stunning. And I liked it more than Steph did. And it took... Irish children make their Holy Communion in May. And it wasn't until the Christmas that our Lord and Saviour Santa Claus came and got me a Super Nintendo. And
we're all just waiting around religious festivities.
Like, because you got the SNES and you kept it for 10 years, you know?
Yeah,
like, it was
a
huge, huge deal. And I got mine with Super Mario All-Stars, which was 5 games in one, but no Yoshi's Island. So when Steph and I would play Mortal Kombat, The Lemmings, Yoshi's Island, whatever, all the time until eventually tides change, things become different, you know, your interests diverge. You're still friends, but one of you is obsessed with video games and the other one isn't.
Yeah.
Donkey Kong Country 3 and 2 were the other two games we used to play, which is when I'm hungover or sad, I will still open up Donkey Kong Country 2 and play it like a musical instrument to soothe myself. I know it inside and out.
It's like you playing Wonderwall sort of thing.
Yeah,
like, I'm just like... I know this and it brings me somewhere.
Anyone want to see a cool trick? To see how fast I can get through this? Yoshi's Island looks like a girl's game.
Mm-hmm.
It's full of flowers. It's full of tiny pink dinosaurs. It's full of babies. I tried to play it again recently, thinking that I could open up and I would have muscle memory and feel like, ah, yes, I beat this as a 6-year-old. I would like you to think about what is a 6-year-old? A plant. A sentient plant, you know?
A sentient plant!
Like, when you're 6, you're just...
Yeah.
It is impossible. It's so hard. It's so hard, Caroline. It's a really difficult game.
That
it requires patience, repetition. It is not fair to the player. It is a pain... And I am staggered by the patience and smarts that we had as kids, the two of us, 2 6-year-old girls, and this extremely unforgiving platformer that is very cute, but very... I challenge any of you to pick that up and not feel like the world is against you. It is not a friendly game. And when you get hit by an enemy, Baby Mario pops off your back, goes into a bubble, and then starts crying. It is a bait. So when you... And you have to get it back before he gets kidnapped. So when you are in peril, the sound that you hear is a screaming baby. It is a very difficult game. And when we were 6, we worshipped at it like it was an altar. Like, we loved it.
Wow.
And we beat it.
And you beat it. That is... I think that's something when people come back to old games a lot, they're amazed by how difficult they are. And
oh,
they're
boy.
Like, how on earth? It's like, because you had nothing else on.
Oh, you had endless hours.
You had nothing else. It was you and the TV.
Oh.
In like probably an upstairs bedroom with like a shitty old TV.
Yeah. And a closed door and nobody to talk to you and only focus. But it's still hard. It's... you can look up a guide that will tell you where to jump, but this is not an easy game. So, like, the appearances can be deceiving, you know, with girls' games and things like that, you know? And, like, the games that brought me into and like, we've discussed before that Pokemon is a girls' game, right?
It's a girls' game. It's also a gays' game.
Yeah, big time.
Because... and it's so interesting. The adults you meet that still play Pokemon, they're me and my brother. And they're also... and like, overwhelmingly, it's a lot of queer people.
Yeah, overwhelmingly. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
it's lovely.
And I think about that a lot because, like, what happens in the first 5 minutes of every single Pokemon game? You leave home. And I find that really beautiful.
Yeah.
You leave home. You're raised exclusively by a loving mother.
Yeah.
As never a father figure, as canon. And you're asked to... You leave home, you go to cities and you make friends and you have a little found family, which are your core 6 team, you know?
Yeah. Off you go.
Yeah.
You know, God, that's a really, really powerful way of looking at it. That leaving home fantasy and that freedom.
Yeah.
I keep going back to freedom because that's
the
ultimate power fantasy of so many people.
And maybe that's a more useful rubric for understanding this. Not what's a girl game, what's a boy game, but what does your version of freedom look like?
Is it subjugation or is it limitless wandering and no danger? Not no danger, but like danger you can manage.
Yeah.
Danger that you can triumph against. You know, peril, but not...
And that the game wants you to triumph against.
The world is rooting for you.
The world is rooting for you. Totally. And like, I think about, you know, your Pokemon, Animal Crossing, all those, Harvest Moon. Yes, it's about resource management and keeping your bits in order.
Yeah.
Which is soothing and nice. But it's also just about like, this is your bit. This is your bit now and you can do anything you want with your bit. You can have your turnips over there or you can have bees.
Yeah. Bees are where the money's at.
Bees are where the money's at.
And
bees
pigs,
and mayonnaise.
Truffles. Yeah, mayonnaise. A lot of money in mayonnaise.
A lot of money in mayonnaise.
More money in truffles and truffle oil. But
most of it's being about let alone to do what you want. And I think that's such a big thing of the female fantasy because we, like, it's almost like boringly depressing to point out. We're still not able to, like, explore the worlds with perfect freedom.
I feel this all the time.
Any approach.
I live at the foot of a mountain, which sounds more romantic than it is. I live in a suburb, but I do live at the foot of a mountain. And even with my dog, my Pokemon with me. I am not safe in those woods.
Yeah.
In Hyrule, I can go anywhere. I can climb.
And you got your sword and shield.
Yeah. 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 And pretty fast set of feet with a decent enough stamina bar. I can run if I'm stuck. You can't run here. I wrote an essay about this for the Stingfly last year about hiking. And the reason that I am an outdoor adult is because I was an indoor kid. And the thing that made me curious about the natural world and the thing that made me want to hike and walk long distances, which I do, was playing Zelda. And that sense of limitless and that sense of the pasture and the forest and being curious in the world. But unfortunately, I require a male escort. There's a game called Ico where it's an old PS2 game from a series which includes another game called Shadow of the Colossus, which is beautiful, where your job is to escort a princess more or less through a series of dangerous places and rescue her by leading her. And there is nothing more crushing than the realization that you do require a consort to get through the world when all you want to do is roam.
I remember feeling that so deeply because, as I mentioned, during COVID was when I sort of had my big games renaissance. I did Breath of the Wild and then started Skyrim and did lots of the indie games that we'll talk about later that are so delightful, and I will get anybody back into gaming if they've had a long rest. But around that time, there was a very famous murder of a young woman called Sarah Everard. And, you know, it was very much a London thing, and she was our demographic, and she was murdered by a policeman. And I felt so angry for weeks. It's interesting because the podcast we were doing, Sentimental in the City, at the time, and there's a podcast around then when we're bursting to tears a lot.
Yeah.
And both me and Dolly have talked a lot about that and being like, we weren't crying about the show.
No.
Just we were crying about that as well. And
you wrote a column for the Examiner about freedom around that time, which I spoke to my mother about doing yoga in the park.
What would I do if women didn't get murdered? I would do yoga at night.
Yeah.
I would do yoga at night. And I would talk to weirdos on the bus.
Yeah.
Because I wouldn't be afraid that they would get off the bus at my stop and follow me home. I would have sympathy for everyone I met because women don't get murdered.
More compassion, more love.
Yeah. And that's what you do in these games. You go anywhere and you talk to anyone.
You could help anyone because they are not going to kill you.
Yeah.
If someone asks you for a weird gold insect, you say, sure, honey.
I'll fucking sort
I'll
that out for
get
you.
It. No problem.
I will pass an enormous forest at night and find it for you and bring it back for a small reward.
For 20 rupees, and I'll go roll my eyes and go, only 20 rupees, but it was worth
it. It was a hell of a time.
It was a hell of a time. Yeah, that's the sad part of the fantasy is that it is one and it remains one because that is how the world is. And it's the same. We've had a few of those. We've had a string of those kind of murders, women in public. By men in the last year or so. There was one where the woman was just out running.
At like 4 o'clock in the day.
In the middle of the day.
Yeah.
And you get reminded all the time, and I find it in the winter especially, how limited your freedom is, how limited your access to public spaces.
Yeah.
I can
When that sun goes down at 3:45 or whatever.
You're done.
You're done. And Go back inside, girly. Like.
And I can see the forest, and I would love to walk around it with my dog. I'm not afraid of anything in that forest other than men.
Oh, God.
You know? So if I had a sword and shield, I'd be okay.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
but I don't. So I go instead to these digital forests and these digital places because I have more power and therefore more freedom.
God, I hate that it's that sad.
And it's that simple.
And that simple, yeah.
You know, and I know it's not the same for everybody. I know this is not the same, the concern of every other woman.
It's only part of a huge fantasy, you know?
Yeah, it is. And everybody is drawn for different reasons. But for me, it's a sense of transportation and I can go here and I am under no threat. And if I am afraid when I hear that, especially in Breath of the Wild, when you realise that one of the ancient guardians can see you, I can just peace. I can just leave.
Peace.
I can just leave.
Yeah.
And that's a fantasy in itself too. You know?
Just leaving. God, that's, we're getting heavy here. Mm-hmm. But one thing you and I were both loved and were very interested in was the fact that the runaway sort of summer blockbuster book was a book called Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, which we both adored. And I would recommend to anybody listening to this podcast. But it was this interesting thing. It's kind of why I've timed this podcast for now, really, is that it was this kind of clash that was like, oh, yeah. Hundreds of thousands of women are men, mostly, it is mostly women. Mm-hmm. Like it just as a basic rule, the people who are reading novels are women.
Yeah.
Like that,
especially
is
novels by women.
Especially novels
overwhelmingly
by women.
Yeah.
That's, yeah. I remember when I was putting out my first book, I said to my team, how will we get to male readers? And they just went, oh, sweet summer child. So hundreds of thousands of women were willing to and adored reading 350 pages about mostly about games development and the people who make those games and their relationships. And you could argue that, like, you know, people just like reading about creativity. People like reading about friendships. People like reading about
love
and unconventional relationships. Yeah. But they loved reading about games.
They really did.
And it sort of was the sort of clash being lifted of being like, oh, there's lots of us.
Did you put your, like, you know, there's a, you played The Sims, you were there. How was your Harvest Moon experience? Like that. And then you realize that there's more of us here. There's always been more of us here. We just didn't say it.
Yeah.
Or we were told to shut up by teenage boys or brothers. And
told, like, the games that we liked weren't real.
Yeah.
Weren't real games or were bad games.
Or you are simply doing this for male attention.
Oh,
you are doing this to perform. And that's what I think I said it earlier about not being like other girls and that perpetual accusation of you only play video games because you want boys to like you.
Yeah.
And there is a time in many teenage girls' lives, or there certainly was, where that is the only shred of power that you have, you know, is that your interests happen to align with something that men like, and therefore you might get temporary grace as a girl with no taste from the patriarchy.
Yeah.
But turns out lots of girls kept playing, lots of them. And the times that we spent playing, even if we didn't keep playing, mattered to us. And I think you're right that Gabrielle Zevin's book pulled back something.
Yeah.
And then what you see under that cloth is girls holding controllers.
Yeah.
You know, even ones that they had forgotten that they had been holding as children or teenagers, you know.
Yeah.
And the game, or not the game, the book has these lovely, lovely moments of discussion because it's set in the 90s about important video games. A very particularly funny passage about Metal Gear Solid that I really
loved. That thing.
I loved it. But there's also games within the novel, right? Mm-hmm. There's a game which I felt was a bit like Ico, which I mentioned earlier. There is a Maple World, which is sort of a Stardew Valley MMORPG, which also, wow, would be great. God, I'm going to lose 3 years, something like that myself. You know, there are games in the story that feel fully realized and like places you would want to go, and like, not like existing properties, but in conversation with existing properties in the way. It's a book about art. It's a book that is looking at a really important moment of history and culture and treating video games as what they are, which is more than a toy, but also a text and a place that those two things live. It's a book that respects video games as well as loves them. Mm. So,
and there's a line in that book early on that's where the game developer Sadie says, is quoted in an interview and then is re-quoted many times throughout her life, of saying that play is better than sex.
Yes, yes, that it's almost more intimate than sex. And I agree. I really, really do, because you're so vulnerable when you are. And I think that that's a little bit why tabletop is having its moment at this time and is a real serious place where communities are forged, is because you can go there and be vulnerable. Because when you're playing, you're not working, you know.
Yeah.
You're not the other thing. You have to be vulnerable. And I don't know. I'm really glad that that book resonated with so many other people, because I get to talk to women about it. Because getting to talk to women about video games,
like,
is amazing.
It's like this crowbar that opens up on women and gaming and talking about. Because, like, there's something that a friend of the pod, Joff Owen, said during the Twee episode that I think about a lot. And he said it about music. And he said, when guys come up to me after shows, they really want to get under the hood and they want to talk about guitar pedals and tuning and that kind of stuff. And he's like, and women want to talk about lyrics. And obviously he wasn't trying to be binary either, but this is just overwhelmingly his experience. But I think about this a lot with all kinds of sort of hobby making, really. It's like when men talk to each other about games, again, not trying to be binary, but it's a lot about like, what level did you clear? What boss did you be? What thing did you get, kind of thing? And I think that's fine. But I think women don't have the lexicon for talking about games in the way that interest us. It's just like, how did you feel?
How did you
Who
feel?
Did you talk to?
Yeah.
Which little jar of flies did you collect?
Did you see this room?
Yeah. Did you see the room? Did you see the carpets in the room?
Did you talk to the guy? Did you talk to the guy under the tree? What did he say to you?
Isn't it great when you're walking on the carpet, how you can sort of feel it, even though you're not walking on with your feet, but you can feel it?
Texture rather than specs. And specs and inside baseball, which is how does this game relate to the previous iterations of this game? Mm-hmm. Gaming as a set of facts, statistics, and modern cultural history rather than a set of feelings that you can experience in the moment. And I also am obviously interested in the history of gaming because it's so fresh. It's 50 years old, give or take. It's something a drum that I beat all the time is the distance between the first moving picture and Citizen Kane is 50 years. And the difference between now and Pong is about 50 years.
Wow.
Right? So what we should be experiencing in the last decade or so is the Citizen Kane of video games, which is the worst thing to say out loud. I'm so sorry for saying this. But that's where we should be.
Yeah.
That is where we should be right now. The medium has found itself, right? We are entering a time where it's not just input output. Mm. It's not just, two surfaces flicking on a screen.
It's profound emotional artistic responses to profound emotional and artistic pieces of work.
And the people who grew up playing them are making them. Right.
Yes.
So we're entering postmodernism. We're entering a state of reference as well, which is great fun. It's so rewarding. But that means that the standard is really, really different. And the games that we get to play now do feel like art sometimes. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the act of play is so pure that it feels like art, or sometimes it just feels like exploring somebody else's emotions. There's much more options. There's much more different ways to go. But the medium is really up on its legs. We're in a really amazing age,
Yeah. Yeah, we are. It's an exciting time to be alive. It's like, it's not an exciting time to be a movie fan.
No, like, it sure is not.
Sorry, it's not. Like,
hope you like green screens.
I hope you like green screen. Like, obviously, we're in a great movie phase right now because it's Oscar season in a couple of months and they've saved all the good ones.
So. Come on, Ireland.
Come on, Ireland. Fucking Banshees. We've got our spate of 5 or 6 good movies, and the rest of the year it would be fucking shit.
Yeah.
And so that art form, I think, is sort of dying, but there are other art forms that are growing, and video games is one of them, because self-publishing is easier than ever and there are more people making more kinds of games than ever. But I just to slightly alter, I was talking to Gav last night about, he was asking if Roller Coaster Tycoon is a girl game. And I was like, oh yeah, absolutely.
Theme park.
And all kinds of like theme hospital I wasn't Roller Coaster Tycoon, but I was very much theme hospital, but like the building of businesses, and he said, there's an absolutely straight line between people who played Roller Coaster Tycoon as a kid and people who became graphic designers later in life.
I get that. Really pleasing organisation.
And I started thinking about what was the straight line that led to me being a novelist. And I think if you can call chat rooms a video game.
Yes, they are. Oh, boy. Yeah. That is very real.
A video game, and the object was to convince people in married chat rooms that I, a 12-year-old, was a married 20-year-old. And to convince them to have cyber sex with me.
Oh, man. Those wild days, those strange like blank screens filled with weird text where you could do and say anything.
And you can make other people do and say things.
The great MMORPG. It's all just till they're teenage girls, by the way.
Oh, I know.
It's all just till they're teenage girls.
I was telling Kathy the other night, I was like, one time I went on this thing of like pretending to be this married 20-year-old who lived on an army base.
Oh, cool,
and
cool.
Had only anal.
Oh, that's a very specific line. That's a specific quest for you to go on.
I just wanted to think of the most extreme things I could think of, and like and the idea that like I thought I was talking to like 40-year-old married men, I was probably talking to 12-year-old boys.
Oh man, they remember you somewhere in the strange nexus of their memory that like planted a terrible seed. And what else does a novelist want to do other than plant terrible seeds?
Plant terrible seeds.
I don't know, mine directly goes back to video games. Mine completely, my life as a novelist goes back to video games. It's The Legend of Zelda Majora's Mask. And mm-hmm. every time I go back to that, I feel different. And every time I go back to it, I marvel that, again, as 11 years old, I was capable of dealing with how difficult it is. It's also a very sad, very weird game. And I think it's an experience. The Legend of Zelda, The Ocarina of Time, and The Legend of Zelda Majora's Mask are a real pair of powerful texts in the canon. And that were from Ocarina of Time for many years was referred to as the best video game ever made, the greatest video game of all time. Mm. But it's in that other place that I learned that I wanted and needed to make other places, you know?
Yeah.
And that feeling of, and it's also quite scary, a place to go to be. Now, you're always equipped and you're always, you know, you have the sword and the shield and the magic and the hookshot and all the bits and pieces you need.
Crucially, gaming was not traumatic. I mean, dying was not traumatic.
No, you fall and you rise again, right? You fall and you rise again. And it's annoying at most, but it wasn't distressing. And that was my starting point. And every so often I meet another Majora's Mask person. Mm. And it's a very the girls that get it moment.
Yeah.
You know?
I definitely think that, like, from my own, the straight line between me getting into YA and the last 45 seconds of Ocarina of Time.
Oh.
Because there's a moment where, so you've played as Link, you were first a Kokiri child, and then you find out that you're not a Kokiri child, you're actually just
you're
a human.
Hiding, yeah.
You go forward in time, you're a big strong man.
With a little cute earring.
and then you save the world from destruction, and you've seen the worst things.
Yeah.
And, you know, you've seen the marketplace in
fire full of the dead.
Full of zombies. And it's upsetting and it's awful.
God, that change in Hyrule Castle Town when it goes from this vibrant medieval little sesh
full
town.
Of, like, chickens. Such a sesh town.
It's scorched. It's scorched when you go back.
And it's different to, you know, it's different to watching a movie or seeing a TV show because it's you and it's your town and they wrecked your town in the time that you were asleep. And so you fight Ganon and you undo all this
in the fallen castle.
But then you go back and then they send you back in time. And there's this beautiful moment where, like,
you put the sword back in the stone.
You do. And all the village people and all your friends are dancing and they never knew what happened because you stopped it from happening. But then the last sort of frame is Link just sitting on a log and looking fairly melancholy. And you're like, oh, everything he's seen, he has to just go back to being a child, knowing that he's not really a Kokiri.
And Majora's Mask happens directly after. It's this psychic, sorrowful journey that he goes on. After his adventure, after he's just done this horrendous time travel situation where he has lived in an adult's body and saved the world, and his little companion Navi the fairy leaves him, like, she flies into the window, you know, she leaves and he's alone. So at the beginning of Majora's Mask, he's going through the forest on Epona by himself looking for his friend, who the only person who was with him consistently through the journey and who witnessed his time travel and his victory. The only part, and he never finds her. She's gone. So, like, huge stuff.
That's so just like what I'm interested in when I write YA, which is like the things we ask of children and then we ask them to grow up.
Mm.
And like, I find it so fat. And like, Zelda is just a video game series, and I know you're the expert and I've only played a couple of games, but like, it's so interested in trauma.
It is. It's so interested in pain. It's so interested in pain because Link is he is a swordsman, but Link is a girl, but in my opinion. But Link is a swords person and is also a healer.
Yeah.
Link moves from town to town to city and heals people along the way. If you ask Link to get you something, Link will get it for you. Link fixes small problems and big problems and calamities and missing chickens all the way across. And the use of music in Ocarina of Time is something that I feel like I hear artists and creators talk about a lot, that it's a healing thing. When you play music, you fix things. You can make rain come. You can pause time for a moment. You can... Their healing is at the core of what Link does. And Majora's Mask does a really, really good job of looking at... Like, it's really a game about death. Like, you wear the masks of three dead figures in order to inhabit their bodies as you move through. This is like a gnarly game for real. Like, when you talk about it out of context, you're like, that's not chill at all. But it is the song that you play when you in order to acquire the mask that is their spirit is the song of healing.
Yeah.
Like, so Link is a healer, and that is a lot to ask of a child, to be a champion and a cleric and all of those other things, you know. Mm. And those are the questions that you have to get to when you're writing for young people, because those are the questions that they are asked by the world every day. You know,
yeah.
Like, they're, it's the big and the small. It's the calamity and the chickens.
That's so much part of calamity and the chickens. Part of growing up is knowing how much you can take.
Yeah, yeah.
And when you got to peace out.
When you got to hit the bricks.
When you got to hit the bricks. Gary Zabra, man, you got to teleport out.
Mm-hmm. Gary Zabra.
Gary Zabra will only mean things to a very small number of people, but I love you all. God, we got. People are going to be expecting, oh, they're going to talk about Nintendogs.
We sure aren't.
We sure are not.
What if Zelda was just about pain?
What if it was just about pain? But another thing about, and I think a lot of people play Breath of the Wild during the pandemic.
Mm.
And something that I found oddly soothing about it was it's 100 years after the disaster.
It's after the war.
It's after the war, and like, there's very few villages left and there's lots of ruins, but people are making a go of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that very silly.
They all
maybe heavy handed as a metaphor.
No, but they all have a lot of hope in them, I think.
Yeah.
And there is a limitlessness to Breath of the Wild because it's a non-linear dungeon structure, which is, again, a boring inside baseball term, but it's non-linear. You don't have to do anything in any particular order.
Yeah.
You just go. You can do what you can do. You can handle what you can handle. A lot of the progression is not actually to do with combat, it's to do with puzzle solving. I love a puzzle. Mm. And the ruins and the woods and the people you meet along the road, like, it's a resilient, Hyrule is a resilient world because there have been so many Hyrule. Zelda's nearly 30, you know, and there have been so many iterations of that space. And I think what was so moving for a lot of people playing Breath of the Wild was, this is a world that we saw on the Super Nintendo system in pixels, and suddenly it feels completely real.
Yeah.
And also suddenly, if you want to spend 2.5 hours just collecting durian fruit in the tropical part of things, or looking at the dragon coming up and out of the lake and watching the lightning dragon coming off its scales, then you actually don't have to go to deal with Ganon at all, to be honest.
Actually, it's like,
you can just mosey.
It's profoundly unrewarding to beat the game.
Yeah, it's sort of
there's no after game.
You know, there's the game is the after game, so there's kind of no pressure, you know. Which is and it's not really gated in a meaningful way, so you can just keep walking until the end of the world. Anything that you can look at, you can touch, which is, again, about freedom. And during the pandemic, when there was approximately none, I can understand why people were drawn to this world, because it was hopeful, you know, and it was limitless. What a combo.
You
know?
Something that came up a lot when I asked on Instagram about what kind of girl games they wanted to cover. A lot of like...
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Those movie games and franchise games, TV, the Mary-Kate and Ashley games, enormous amount of fans, the Barbie games, the sort of Harry Potter Hogwarts games, I think have gone viral in recent years.
Woof.
I find it really interesting that there was this period where if something was big enough to have a movie, it was big enough to have a game. And that does not exist anymore.
There are copies of Shrek games knocking around, man. Like, the one thing about the video games moving from a hard object into a digital object. I worked in a video game shop for 3 years, maybe 2 years, 100 years in my soul. Maybe I'm still,
I've never left.
A part of me is still there. But it was at that at a turning point of sort of the year of the Wii, which that ages
Wii.
Me, I think. Age yourself by technology.
I'd like to go back to the Wii in a minute, but carry on.
But there, the secondhand section of the game shop was absolutely rammed with adaptation games that nobody ever wanted to play again because they were churned out as a piece of merchandise as opposed to a thing in itself. But they are made by people and there is always going to be glimmers of goodness about them, you know. And sometimes these games are also what you bring to them and what you make of them. And I think there's a whole pocket of those games around various celebs and toys for capital F, capital G, for girls that were really pleasurable and really, really delightful, you know.
For me, a big thing was horse games.
Horse games.
Did you horse game?
Not a horse girl. Not a horse, photography girl. The other one. Yeah.
Yes, photography games. Photography Pokemon girl. Snap for the N64, big one.
And the new one is really good as well. I think the new one's really chill. Yeah.
There were quite a few, because there was also like a real time where you could just get a demo of a game anywhere.
Oh, free with a magazine.
Free with a magazine.
Yeah.
There was a wildlife photography game that I played a couple levels of. The horse games is an interesting one because it spoke to an ache. Not just a fantasy, the way Harvest Moon speaks to a fantasy.
No, a need.
But an ache. Because, if you're, I think I'm going to do a total separate episode on horses, to be honest.
You
should. There's a lot there.
Yeah.
But this thing of the only access you get to horses, maybe if you're lucky, is like this little window of time where your mom drives you to the riding stable down the road once a week or once a month even or less. And the rest of the time you need to fill in desperately that time with horse experience before when you own your horse.
This is really beautiful, Caroline. I feel like you're very vulnerable right now. I'm like, your love of horses is amazing to me and I completely understand. It's a bridge. You know what's a horse game?
What?
Zelda.
Zelda's a horse game.
You know? But that is a... Because in real life they are large, scary, untamable, expensive animals.
But who don't love you.
No. Dead stare. I find them very frightening. I'm very
sure
scared of them.
Yeah, I mean, people are going to write in being like, my horse loves me. I don't think he does. Your horse is not.
Charlotte Polo doesn't love you. He's just hungry, you know. But for real, I think that it doesn't demystify them, but I feel that thing, that ache of the unknown and the great untamable beast that suddenly then lives in your screen and you can engage in a fantasy with them. You can engage in an intimacy with them that otherwise is.
And it was
just,
I also sort of like buy horse magazines because I was so convinced that one day there will be a reality in which I own a horse and I will need to know everything. And like, so scraping out my horse's hoof on like a riding star or whatever, or Barbie's horse games was like, I'll need to do this every day. So I better do it every day.
It's
here.
The life you build for yourself.
The life you build is the fantasy. Line,
oh my god, that's gorgeous. Yeah.
This is the first year of my life where I've had enough money to go to horse riding lessons.
Every so often on Instagram you put up a video or like a clip from of you moving around on horseback and I'm just like happy for you. You're just jaunting along in a field and I'm like, you look so free and happy.
I that's it. It is
your back is upright, you know. Like you're just, it's like you've always been doing it. Do you know what I mean? And you have.
I was. I was in my youth. But then
but also in your head and in your heart.
And in my head. I feel about horses the way I feel about gaming in that I took a break but I never quit.
No, your heart doesn't quit.
The heart never quits.
No,
the heart
way.
Goes last.
No. And what an amazing thing to be a grown-up who can pursue, when we were doing like the bummer section earlier where there's no freedom. There is also a lot to be said for the pockets where you can go and do the fun thing. If I wanted, I could go take archery lessons. That's a thing that my grown-up person self could do. That is, there's nothing stopping me doing
it. Take a couple of buses.
Other than my shoulders.
Yeah.
But I could go learn how to hold a sword. I could do that if I wanted. You know, if that was the call for me, I could, there would be nothing on earth stopping me doing it. And that is the nice thing about turning into an adult, I think, and leaving behind certain things from youth and childhood, is that you have access, you know.
Yes, to play is waiting for you.
Yeah, to play. You can actually go and play, because horse riding is play.
It is,
you know?
It very much is play. There was a very sly humour to The Sims as well.
Oh yeah.
It was sort of like, it knew how bizarre it was, you know?
A wink and a nudge.
A wink and a nudge. Like, obviously the thing everyone remembers is the whoopee bed where you could just make them fuck.
Again, everyone's standing around the laptop going, are we going to make him do it?
Are we going to make him do it?
Are we going to do it? Are we going to do it? Okay, and we're going to do it, you know?
The sort of like the hidden poetry of it as well, because nobody I knew played The Sims without cheats. And cheats are their own thing, I
they're
think.
They're their own language, you know,
but
their own...
This actually circles back to what you said earlier on, which is the Citizen Kane of gaming. What is the code for infinite money on The Sims? Rosebud.
That's beautiful. And that's beautiful.
As soon as you use Rosebud, you can get anything you want and the game gets less fun.
Yeah, yeah. I'm playing a hack of Stardew Valley at the moment. Yeah. And I have, because I felt that I had been playing it for so long that I had earned a round of mods. And it's turning me into a monster. Like, it's turning me into a bad person. Like, I'm not playing by the rules. I am a mogul in that town. And it feels, cheating in games feels like, transgressive.
It does feel transgressive, even though they left those things in for you to discover.
They did. And like glitching, I you know, my sort of my soothing evening watcher when I'm writing, my background thrum is people doing speedruns of Zelda.
So explain to audience what
a speedrun is when a person plays a video game extremely fast on purpose for an audience. If that sounds boring, I assure you it is not. It's an esport of its own, but it often requires corrupting and breaking a game in order to do it. So when I watch people play Zelda and try to beat The Legend of Zelda: The Ocarina of Time in 15 minutes or whatever, I'm watching somebody take a perfectly crafted world that I loved and grew up with and shatter it. Push themselves through walls, you know, do things they shouldn't be able to do, go places they shouldn't be able to go.
Yeah.
And it feels like something that I haven't worked out yet and I hope to write about eventually, because I don't know what that feeling is. It's like looking at a beloved childhood book through the other side of the page. It's something, again, transgressive. It feels subversive. It feels weird. But it's just a broken object. It's just looking at the Rubik's... It's just pulling the Rubik's Cube apart. It's just turning the Monopoly board upside down. It's not really that deep, but it feels deep.
There's this meme that I think you and I are guilty of sharing multiple times to our mutual Instagrams, which is, you know, Sid from the Toy Story... the horrible kid next door who breaks all the toys and like nails them onto other toys.
He was an artist.
Is something like, what's the exact quote? It's like, he was just making art. How was he supposed to know they were alive? They shouldn't be.
They shouldn't be. He was just making art.
There's something about the cheater and the modder in games that is very Sid from next door. It's like, you're making new art from the art.
You're pulling this apart to build something new and corrupted and beautiful. Me and Carrie played a Legend of Zelda randomizer recently, which is exactly what it sounds like, in that every chest you open has something in it that shouldn't be there.
Yeah.
So the first chest you open, which should be a sword, isn't. It's a bottle. Good luck. You know, or something different. It completely, it scrambles the progression of the game. So you get some things too early, some things too late, and you have to navigate the world by a different set of rules. It feels unholy. It feels dangerous because of the, but it's really just a broken toy, you know? But it's also a text at the same time.
Yeah, and so, there's nothing quite like that.
No,
you know?
It's a great, it's a weird feeling. It's a really hard to describe feeling. I don't know. I don't know if I'll do it that much. I feel like it's something that I don't... I enjoy the straight narrative of games much more than the corruption, but I think I had to dip my toe in. I can't believe that code was Rosebud. What perfect circularity.
Isn't
you know?
That great?
That's unbelievable.
And the thing about Sims as well that I always find very haunting is I can never remember the name of the guy who made it, Will something. He came up with the idea for the game following a house fire where he lost all his possessions, and how he got his insurance payout, and he found it weirdly pleasurable replacing everything he owned and going through catalogues and whatever. And he's like, oh, maybe I can distill that feeling into a game.
Wow.
And he's like, it's so interesting because the way Sims began is how all games of Sims end, with a house fire.
With a house fire. That's all we want to do.
Yeah.
All we want to do is
see it burn.
Cause true chaos.
Yeah.
That's brilliant.
Build the most beautiful house you can build with the most money that you have. Kill a bunch of people and then burn it down.
Do whatever you... Ultimate freedom. Ultimate freedom. You know? Like, that's like Stardew Valley too. If you are... Once you've completed the game, gotten married and had a couple of children, your farm is rolling, you can simply visit the witch. Divorce your spouse, visit the witch, erase their memory, turn your children into doves and start again. You know? Like, there... And there's a corruption to that, you know?
Yeah.
It's a... yeah, that's power too, man. That's real power.
There's something about those kind of free games that teaches you something about yourself. You're like, darkness lives in all of us.
Oh, yeah. What can you do out there?
Yeah.
Know? Whatever you want.
Okay, yeah. We're getting towards the end of the podcast now, but I would really like to talk about, I mean, there's lots of stuff that we didn't touch on. And I think mostly because they were suggested and they were requested, but you and I don't have experience of them. So I'm just going to rattle through and you tell me if you have any thoughts, and we'll just go, and then we'll end on some recommendations for some new games that people might really love.
Lightning round.
Star Dolls.
Oh, the thing where you put the clothes on the pixel girls, right? Yeah. Loved it. Wild Away Hours, very empty head, like chicken fillet brain, smooth, not a single wrinkle, just putting the clothes on the doll. Delightful.
Habbo Hotel.
I haven't got a clue what it is, man.
I remember it being, because there were ads for it in the back of Ms. Magazine, Habbo Hotel, and then I think it became really rife with pedos.
Oh no, is it like Neopets?
I think so, similar to Neopets. Anything on Neopets?
Loved it. Accidentally put my Shoiru up for, which was painted like a crystal, up for adoption, and then never played it again. Neopets is genius. It was lovely. I played it a lot as a child. But I remember giving away my one little particular guy and then not wanting to play it anymore.
The heart went out of it for you.
Yeah.
A deep cut, but mentioned by many people, the Sabrina the Teenage Witch video game.
No.
So I watched it on YouTube, and I totally forgot. I did play this.
What was it on?
It may have been, I think, PlayStation and PC.
Yeah. Is it Mrs. Joan Hart?
Well, it's hand-drawn animations, most of it.
Wow.
But it has the voice actors.
Okay.
So, the animations are not great. But the whole thing, it's so small, but also gets to the heart of what girls and what children really, really loved about Sabrina, which was that house.
Oh, the house. I can see.
Yeah, her bedroom. And the other realms. So the whole game was inside of her house and just like collecting spells
the
and like going to the spell book.
The other, yeah,
yeah, yeah. There's something.
Like dining room.
The dining room would be shown very seldom.
And the stairway up to her bedroom. Like I can see it. I lived in that house too. Yeah.
I know. We all lived in that house in our heads. And like, it's so good. And yes, that entire game was just poking around the house, which is all you ever wanted to do on the TV show.
It's point and click.
Point and click, poke around the house, talk to your cat, go into the other realm.
I mean, that's kind of a bit like, there's a lot of really beautiful indie games that function under that principle as well. You know, it's a really good method to play. You
it's
know?
Kind of like one of those proto indie games in a way. Yeah. What else was there? Have we talked about Theme Hospital a bit?
Yeah, we did.
We did.
Graphic designer, totally.
Yeah. Something about Theme Hospital that really brought out the worst in me was you had to hire and fire everybody who worked at that hospital.
More power.
More power. And like just like firing them for no reason. And like, I know we're of a generation where everyone thinks of themselves as kind of like a real socialist. But like your capitalist notions come out so quickly when you're playing these games. Because you're like, this motherfucker's sick again. Get out of my hospital.
This janitor's not
clean up the vomit. Get out of here.
I think the reason that I didn't play Theme Hospital was because of all the vomit.
There was a lot of horror. A lot of casual horror in Theme Hospital.
It was a bit.
And one of the illnesses you have was like having a big head.
Yeah, I can
really
see that.
In my brain. Yeah.
My mind's eye. I feel like Theme Park did that to me as well. It was a bit gross at times.
Yeah, kind of gnarly.
And I'm not always down for gross. Gross sometimes gets a bit, okay, I'm out for me. And especially when I was like a soft little delicate flower of a teenage girl, I was like, no, I don't look at that.
The worst thing you can be reminded of at that age is bodily functions.
Yeah, tell you what, those games are all crises that you can deal with in Theme Hospital and Theme Park are to do with people who need to use the bathroom or need to throw up real quick. And too soft.
Can't do it.
Yeah.
One thing that came up a few times, and I remember them because when I worked in HMV, I remember there being a lot of them. The Imagine games for the DS.
Oh, so they're like career games, weren't they?
Career games, like Imagine school teacher, Imagine manicurist, Imagine interior designer, Imagine wedding planner.
They would come into the video game shop that I worked in and sit and gather dust, and no one ever bought them.
Yes, same.
I always
thought, who plays these? And apparently, according to my DMs, some people.
Oh, I'm glad. I'm glad that somebody did, because they would just sit there and kind of look at me, and I remember feeling.
And they always got really dirty.
Yeah, because
DS boxes got very dirty and grim very quickly.
The feeling of peeling. You have this from working in a record words, or I'd say that like the feeling of peeling stickers off of those boxes
and
is just
the
like
gluey bits and layering stickers on stickers on top of each other.
It's a real thing. But those games and Cooking Mama, and there was a few other ones around, sort of like they never quite hit the stride of Nintendogs, would sit there and stare out from the shelves and make me feel ashamed. You know, that they was like, look, they made games for girls.
That's it.
And no one is playing them.
Because they were mostly very bad games.
I remember every so often during the year of the DS, which was also the year that I worked in that store, that you would get a mom and a daughter coming in to buy a DS with Nintendogs, and they would ask if there was any other games you'd recommend. And I always said, and it doesn't matter what child came in to buy a DS, I would always say Animal Crossing, always. And I had a bit on Animal Crossing that I did.
What was your bit?
And I, because it's a game for everybody. Mm. It's a game that's non-violent was my big thing. I was just like, you don't have to hit anybody in it if you don't want to. You know, you can't hit them with your net. But you know, I would never say, I was like, you don't have to, it's a non-violent game. It's about building a home. It's about building a community. It's so much fun and it's really different, was the gist of it. And all of your neighbours are little animals and you get to build this town and, you know, like, they're pretty simple sell. Yeah. And I remember once I was doing it and my manager, this dude, came out while I was talking and went, Sarah, Jesus, not everyone is going to like Animal Crossing.
Boy, was he wrong.
And I fully, like, had to stop the interaction to go burst into tears. You know when a man shouts at you?
Oh,
and
no.
I was so embarrassed. The mother who was standing there was, like, really shocked, but he was so cruel. And it was really humiliating. And then the year that my first piece of writing about video games was about Animal Crossing. And it was for The Guardian. And I remember this little 19-year-old me that still lives inside me being like, everyone does like
everyone
Animal Crossing.
You were right. You fucking posed it to him. You were right. It is for everyone.
You were right. Your feeling about it was right. You had the right instinct about it. You weren't wrong. And it won't take away that sound of his voice at that moment of humiliation, of which there were untold trying to work in that shop. And I stayed there until I truly could not stay. I stayed there out of spite at the end. I was like, no, you won't drive me out of here. But I'm so glad that Animal Crossing had its moment. But I do think sometimes about those Imagine games and Cooking Mama and the other ones that didn't. You know, you can't target that hard. Sometimes fall in love with games by accident, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, obviously they made enough money for them to keep making them, and definitely some people played them. And the people who were messaging you about them felt very fondly about them. They blew. They were bad games.
Well, that's the thing. They're bad games because the games that are made in-house by these companies like Nintendo or whatever have a seal of quality about them.
Yeah,
they're well made.
Yeah.
You know they're well made because they have a long history. They originated the medium.
Every bad game that comes out under Nintendo sort of scourges its own name, and it's the last thing it wants to do is curse its own name.
And I tell you what, the Switch eStore is full of absolute garbage water at the moment as well. It's very hard to navigate in there. And Nintendo don't bring out big games very often, and that time and that quality shows, I think, you know. And it's the same with a lot of other AAA producers, but indies have that time and that love as well. There's a real big difference between the games that are made for a quick buck and the games that are made with love in their heart, I think, like all things, you know.
I think that's it in terms of people are going to get so mad.
Oh.
it's just whenever you have a big category like this, there's always going to be people who are just really annoyed that their special thing wasn't talked about.
Sorry, folks.
Can't talk about everything. But let's talk about the games people can get into now.
Yes.
Are
we going to talk about Greg Lobanov? Are we going to talk about Chicory and Wandersong?
Greg Lobanov. I love you, Greg Lobanov.
Greg, we love you.
Greg Lobanov, the only person I have ever written fan mail to
is this
Canadian guy. I think he's like 3 or 4 years younger than us.
I know.
He's made some of the most beautiful games I've ever played.
Yeah,
some of the most pleasurable games I've ever played.
They're incredible.
So the first one is Wandersong. And it's what you would call a Zelda-like. So it's like, it's very on its sleeve about the fact that this is a person who grew up playing Zelda.
A little bard.
You're a bard.
You play a little bard in a green tunic with a green hat, like Link.
And the entire mechanics of the game is singing. It's an explicitly non-violent game.
It's about violence, I would say.
It's about violence, but you, the character, are non-violent. It's about the choice to not be violent every time. And that sounds anodyne, but it isn't.
Oh, it really isn't.
You sing your way out of every problem. You save the world with creativity and singing and togetherness.
And every time you think you know where the story is going, it goes somewhere so surprising. Yeah. It's so subversive and it's so funny.
It's so
The writing is so good. The writing is incredibly good and it's visually delightful.
Yeah.
You know, all of the puzzles that you could solve using a sword, you instead use your voice. So if you need to jump over a cliff and you can't get there, you don't cut down a tree, you sing to a bird and the bird will lift you.
Yeah.
It's the mechanic isn't like capital E easy. It's easy. It's intuitive.
Yeah, and it's forgiving.
It's not frustrating. And the puzzles in it are challenging enough to, you know, to get your brain moving and to ask you to pay attention. But the stories that it tells along this quest that you have as a bard, you really think you know what way you're going. And I will say that this is a real feat of storytelling as well. I was so moved by the ending. I wish I could play it again for the first time. I really, really do. It's such a banger.
It's such a banger. It's also about the sort of chosen one narrative thing.
Who gets to save the world?
Who gets to save the world? And that's so a part of girl gaming.
Yeah.
Of like, girls aren't often the chosen one, you know?
And interestingly, in this story, the girl is the one with the sword.
Yeah.
Which is a real nice turnaround.
But then he followed up with this game called Chicory. And if you're an Animal Crossing head, and if you're a Pokemon head, you are a Chicory head.
Yeah, you're ready. And if you are a person who's played video games and you've ever played a game called Earthbound, this game is in a very long, quiet conversation with an old the Super Nintendo game called Earthbound, and it has a real richness and depth. I think the Zelda game that it's most in the chats with is probably Link to the Past. So it has these lovely elements of classic Nintendo games, but it's also completely its own. It's so unique.
And it's another game that is obsessed with the notion of who's chosen and who's the chosen one who gets to save the world. It seems to be a thing he comes back to a lot as a creator. But it's this idea that you live in a world full of colours. And in this colourful world, it's like very, like, it looks like a colouring book.
A blank colouring book.
So you're the janitor for this this hare called Chicory, and she's the wielder. And the wielder's job is to colour in the world, and that is their sole responsibility. And she is not up to it anymore, and you have to take over. And you sort of learn, you colour in this world, and it's not based on skill.
No.
Like, the game doesn't know whether you're colouring it in well or badly.
Yeah, and it doesn't care.
You just hold the A button on a tree and just and watch a landscape fill with blue.
And you can go and scribble over it if you want.
Yeah.
And oh my God, it's so delightful.
But it's not just a colouring game.
No, it's an adventure game.
It's an adventure, you know?
And the puzzle solving in it does rely on colour, but it's not. It's innovative and surprising.
Yeah.
I really have never played anything like it before.
No.
It's also a game about, while it's about responsibility and who gets to be a hero, it's also a game about how making art feels. And there is definitely a moment that's happening in indie games where games about depression are a big thing.
It's a joke, yeah.
It's a joke. But this is a game about how it feels to not be able to make art anymore. And again, where you think that could be a dreary, heavy topic, it is so hopeful and it's so bold, and it manages to explore very tricky, nuanced things about responsibility and art and heroism in a way that doesn't feel, it feels entirely new. Feels entirely new to me. It's an incredible game.
I love it. Probably one of my favorite things I've ever played.
Yeah, same.
So, and again, very funny.
Very funny. Yeah.
Witchwood is another one you and I both love.
Oh, Witchwood goes. Witchwood spelled with a Y. Now, initially when I saw Witchwood, I was like, not so sure about this.
Yeah.
Witch with a Y.
There's a Morgoth vibe to it, right?
Which, yeah, and I never know how Morgoth I am until I find myself too far down the annals of Morgoth. There is a Morgoth that lives in my heart equally, but who is the same person who worked in the video games for years. But Witchwood, you play a witch who has to deal with a situation in her garden, and is sent around the world to gather little bits and pieces to build effigies and solve problems. And you go from town to town, reckoning with different, big social problems, situations in the town.
Big situations, yeah.
And healing and solving those problems with spells and effigy work. And the world that it's drawn in, I think to me looks like an illustration by Mary Blair. And saying something looks like a Disney, when you say Disney, you get a very specific image in your head. Mm-hmm. But I'm talking about the Disney of Snow White.
Yeah, and yeah, it's a very fairy tale land, but Sleeping Grimm's Beauty, fairy tale. Not Snow, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. It's a very, and there's a lot of lovely colours and a lot of delicacy to
beautiful
it.
Beautiful music.
It's gorgeous music, and just, it's very calming, but the storytelling is really elevated. So you get a lot of that nice resource management vibe from it, but you, and lovely Mary Blair illustrations and picture book feelings.
Yeah.
But the story is, oh, it's so good. It's so, good. And it's long as well. It's a game that you could play for a week. You know, you could play it every night for a week and still kind of, it's got a really good heft to it, as does Wandersong and as does Chicory. They're good games you can spend a good bit of time in, you know.
Definitely. And what's interesting, because we've talked a little bit about like how women, like in girl gamers in general, I don't know, I don't want to, obviously I'm talking about a lot of people, but how the gun thing tends to be less appealing to us, maybe. I don't want to go too hard on that. However, there are some girl games that are out right now that go heavy on the hacking and the slashing and the killing and the murdering, and they, and but while still very much being girl games. One of them is Boyfriend Dungeon.
Oh yeah, it's so good.
The fucking the concept behind Boyfriend Dungeon,
nuts, unhinged.
You are staying, you're subletting your cousin's flat in like a San Francisco type town for the summer, and in this world everyone is hot and is also a weapon.
Yeah.
So like these very hot anime sort of type people, but they're also, they turn into like a dagger at night or a lightsaber.
So the dates that you go on with them, you can also wield them as a literal sword.
So
it's a dating sim and a dungeon crawler roguelike going around battering things in like malls and like schools, and it's, it's bizarre, but it's so good.
What, and what's so brilliant about that is that like your chemistry and your connections with people directly improves your performance in these dungeons. It's not like how many games do where like the character interactions are the secondary thing or they're treated like a secondary thing.
I think
thing.
All games should have a dating option. I think
all games
should have a dating option. No question. It's something I really firmly, you should be able to marry people in all video games, or like just like gently shag around until you've unlocked all the possibilities for life in that world.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is a great one that completely integrates that relationship building and dating element with combat, and it's so satisfying. The combat in it is brilliant. It's quite, I think it's a cousin of Hades in that way, which I also think is a girl game.
Yeah.
I'm playing it at the moment, and I'm trying, I started, my hand started going numb when I was playing it. I was like, oh, this is time to put this down. I'm very late to Hades because it was huge and I was like, this is too big, I'm not looking at it. And then a bunch of years after it came out, I was like, oh, this is actually fantastic. And it has that same dungeon crawling roguelike procedurally generated dungeons where it's different every time you go in. That feeling is
Boyfriend Dungeon is half a dating sim and half a dungeon crawler. Cult of the Lamb is half a cult simulator, which is essentially a kind of an Animal Crossing, right?
You have to look run a little town.
You have to run a little town. You have to look after your disciples. You can sacrifice them.
Make sure no one gets too rowdy, or they go in the stocks.
And so you know, you're trying to keep everybody happy or unhappy, depending on how you want to run your cult. I like to keep people happy. And then by night you go and kill your enemies.
A counterpoint to that one in terms of structure and vibe is a game that I always push on people called Going Under, which is about working in tech.
Yes. Oh my God. If you hate your job,
you will love Going Under.
Yeah.
It's about, you're an intern called Jackie who starts working at a soda startup, and your job as an intern is to go down into the basement to the other failed startups and acquire important relics from therein.
Yes.
One is called Joblin, which is, I guess it's like courier service where there are lots of goblins. Then there's a Styx coin, which is the crypto one, which is like the River Styx and everyone is a skeleton.
Oh,
and then there's
wow.
Winky Dink, which is a dating one where everyone is like sexy devils. So the people who work in the startup send you on missions and you go in and the dungeon changes every time. It's a lot of hitting things with things, a lot of gorgeous design, and again, painfully funny. So well written. The dialogue is very human, very well thought out, very organic.
Yeah.
And it is truly a game that I go back to again and again to relax. It's a great, great game.
See, I will admit I gave up on Going Under because I found it really hard.
It is hard. It is a pain in the ass. Yeah. The difficulty curve is not always, but then when you, there's a point at which you kind of, you hit your stride.
Yeah.
And you could like lots of roguelikes are like that. Mm. I did not beat Cult of the Lamb for the same reason. I got so fucked off that I was just like, I can't do this. But it also doesn't ruin the experience of the game. My cult was perfect, but when I was in the woods trying to deal with the bishops, I was not having a good time after a certain point. So there's always going to be barriers. It's always going to be difficulty limits. But I would also posit that you don't have to finish a game to have a good time.
No, you don't.
I'm not here to win. I'm here to make friends. I'm really, really not here to win. I'm here to make friends and feel things.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh,
so good. Those are some pretty hot wrecks, I think. Those are some pretty good ones. A nice variation.
Great. Yeah. And I also would say as well that, like, if you are somebody who maybe hasn't gamed in a while and you find that, especially in these winter months, your evenings are just disappearing to your phone and sort of like kind of rewatching like The New Girl and kind of being on your phone, and you go
in
to bed.
In the TikTok vortex.
You go to bed feeling both wired and empty. You need one of these games.
You do. Yeah.
The way you will just not be on your phone for several hours is kind of almost enough for me. I know that's pathetic, but I really need something to jolt me out of playing social media like a video game. I mean, social media is the ultimate video game, right? That's the ultimate girl game.
Yeah, where Twitter, where you you accrue a reward by approval or redistribution or engagement. It's all a video game of thought or a video game of performance. That is the true girl game.
Yeah.
God above. So yeah, it's a great place to go. It's the other screen. Mm. What about a screen that is not trying to sell you things? What about a screen that is encouraging you to...
Because it already has your money and therefore it's not trying to sell you anything else.
Exactly.
I mean, some games will try and sell you more stuff, but not the ones we're
recommending. Or fake money. You know, like money that's fake in the game, you know?
Yeah.
I do, there's nothing for me like the feeling of playing a game for the first time and going, oh, I'm going to tell everyone about this. Oh, yeah. If you are daunted about them in terms of entry-level games or games that, like, to be an entry-level game, you have to be just about perfect, I think. Mm. The Goose Game is an entry-level game. The story of the Goose Game is that...
Oh, yes!
It's a lovely day in the village and you are a horrible goose.
You are, yeah.
You just play a goose. You can do two things, honk or pick things up. And your goal is to just ruin the day of everyone around you. It's
so good.
Delightful.
Part of a new genre of games that I've heard being described as being jerkwad games.
Just causing a little trouble.
Yeah, just being
just
a troublesome little guy. You're not the chosen one by any means. You're just a troublesome little guy.
Just a goose. A goose full of chaos. And that for me is, I think that you could play that at 4 years old and I think you could play that at 90 years old. Mm. And it's also, it's not like a beginner game, it's a perfect game and therefore can be played by anybody at all. I would also say A Short Hike is a brilliant game for everybody, where you play a gal who's gone to stay with her aunt on the side of a mountain and you need to go get some cell service to call your mum. So you just walk up the side of the mountain. That sounds dull, I promise you. It's gorgeous.
People love that game.
It's 6 hours long. So if you're not, if you feel like staring down the barrel of a 60-hour experience is a pain in the ass, this is a really great little gem.
Sorry, we keep saying last one, but this is my true last one. if sort of the mechanics and the stress of games isn't for you, but you kind of almost want to play a movie, there's like visual novel games, like, the best of which I think is What Remains of Edith Finch.
Oh, what a game. Yes, it's beautiful.
And you can't lose What Remains of Edith Finch. You are simply playing through a story, and it's about sort of like a horror, it's a very doomed family. It's, if you loved a doomed family saga.
Give me a little Haunting of Hill House. Give me a little Shirley Jackson.
It's very Shirley Jackson. Like, I think it's a great entry point.
Do you know what it is? I think it's a really, really great one. There are so many different ways to play a video game and different kinds of games to play. It's such a rich experience. It does not, it might have began with a gun, but it doesn't end there. You know, it's open. And if Candy Crush is a game, but I assure you there are other ways to stare into nothing, you know. And I play a lot of Candy Crush. I do. I will open up my phone.
I play a lot of Bubble Bobble on my phone.
Bubble Bobble, a true classic. But I think that if you can make the reach across the bridge, or if you were a girl with a controller in your hand and haven't been able to find your way back there, it's waiting for you.
Oh, I really hope people hear this podcast and find their way back.
Find your way back.
It's one of the best. We're waiting for you, you know? We're across the bridge and we're waiting for you. We're asking you to jump.
Come
you
on,
know?
We've got a Pokeball with your name on it, baby.
Because it is one of the best gifts I've given myself in adult life.
It is
an interest in video games.
And the conversations that we've had have been so rewarding. Every so often I'll get a text from you saying, what am I going to play? Or, hey, Griff, what you playing? And that is... that is, it's such a luxury to talk to other women about video games. And
because they want to talk about different stuff.
They do. Everybody's experience with play in that way is so different and beautiful, but you never know how many girls are out there killing their swims in their pools, you know? There's more of us than you think.
I really want to hear from people if they download any of these games that we've recommended.
Oh, yes. God, I really hope you do. I hope you do.
You're at Grifsky on Instagram.
I am. Oh, I'm at Sarah Grifsky on Instagram, at Grifsky on Twitter, but Sarah Grifsky on IG. Yeah.
So come to Sarah with your various preferences and she will give you a game.
Yeah, I'll read your palm.
Yeah.
You know?
Sweet apothecary. Your guys are cheap.
They are.
All right, bye guys. Bye. Thank you, Sarah.
Thanks, Cara.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.